Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want award-winning box sets? Try Now TV. See every epic episode of Game of Thrones, Both Sides of the Law in The Wire, and why Succession got everyone talking. So, treat yourself to award-winning shows on a Now TV Entertainment Pass. To start your 14-day free trial today, search Now TV. 18 plus, new customers only. Auto renews at €15 unless cancelled. Offer ends 7th of July. Terms apply.
Phil Tiger, Slacker Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's Slacker Podcast with myself, Phil Taggart. For the uninitiated of this podcast, my name is Phil. No middle name, Taggart, my mom. I thought it was just a waste of time. To be fair to her, she's right. I'm a DJ and broadcaster on BBC Radio 1. I do a show on a Sunday night at 7 p.m. called The Chillest Show on Planet Earth. And another show called The Hype Chart as well. And apart from that, I'm normally out speaking about music, chatting about music, maybe chasing your dog down the street, shouting musical suggestions at it. You'll probably find me doing that somewhere. If you want to follow me, it's at Philly Taggart on Twitter, at Philly Taggart on Instagram, and it is flipping splendid that you're listening to this podcast right now. We're on episode 9 of season 2. If you're fresh to the Slacker podcast, it's really simple. We get artists on, we talk about those early demos, those really, really early days in the band. The early days are always full of romance and splendor and so much wrong turns. It's always a really interesting place to start. And I really enjoyed last week's one with Johnny Marr. It was one of my favorite ones I've ever recorded because I'm just an absolutely massive Smiths fan. And for him to bring on a demo that hasn't been heard anywhere before off the Smiths was a massive thumbs up for me. This week we have got the one and only Pete Doherty, and I will get to that in just a second, because for anybody who has been following this season's podcast, you will have heard me every single week batter on to you about this book that I've written. Well, finally, it is here. It is out this Thursday, the same day that this podcast drops. And it is available from philtaggartslacker.com or from Amazon. Or if you pop into Rough Trade, you might be able to find a copy as well. The book is specifically for artists and bands and producers and people who might want to start out in the music industry. It takes the music industry and just demystifies the whole thing. It can be a very, very confusing thing. If you've made a song and you're like, I don't know what to do with it next. What do I do? Do I strap it to a carrier pigeon? I don't know how to make a music video. How am I ever going to play these festivals? Nobody's ever going to listen to my band. I've got an album to do. And, you know, those are some of the questions in it. But it's 20 chapters long, and it starts at the very beginning of you making music and goes the whole way through. And it's got contributions from people like Wolf Alice and Slaves and George Ezra and Lil Sims and Run the Jewels and Charlie XCX and people from Polydor Records and people from independent record labels, the PRS publishers, and a massive shout out to the people at Help Musicians. They helped support me during the book and helped the book sort of come to fruition. So massive love to Help Musicians UK for their support. And also they gave some really, really good advice on the mental health chapter, which is called Self-Care, which is chapter 20, and the chapter on funding as well. So mad love to the Help Musicians family for that. So if you've got somebody, a friend of yours or a relation, and they're really mad into making music, buy them the book, philtaggartslacker.com for that. This week, we have Pete Doherty, and it's crazy. Do you know, I'm going to have to listen over to this just before it goes out again, because he goes into a lot of graphic detail in it. I'm a humongous Pete Doherty fan. Like the Libertines were one of those sort of bands that you have when you're growing up that mean a lot to you. Like they definitely were seminal to me in my sort of making music, playing in bands. When we used to play in bands, we used to run about in military jackets and we used to cover Libertine songs. I've just got such happy memories of listening to their first album and their second album. And I've been following Pete Doherty's career, as pretty much most people have over the years, because he's been in and out of the papers for many different reasons. But I'm just a fan of the music that he makes, and that's exactly what we're here to talk about today. He brought in a really special unheard demo of Can't Stand Me Now. And do you know what? The lyrics are so different in it, and I mean the whole song's so different that it kinda almost changes what it was all about and why people and why journalists and why people gravitated towards it, because that song was about the sort of friction between Carl Barat and Pete Doherty at the point where the band was basically breaking up. So it's interesting to hear what it was like in the demo, and almost more interesting to think about where it actually ended up. But I will shut up now, apart from saying buy my book, philtaggartslacker.com. Jesus, I really am shameless. I'm also getting really good at talking about it now because I've done about a billion interviews. So here we go, this week's podcast with Pete Doherty in 3, 2. Oh, and just before we get to one, I'm going to take a couple of weeks break now because I am exhausted with all of the book stuff and podcast stuff and everything. So I'm just going to take a couple of weeks to myself, and I'm going to come back in June at some point with the remainder episodes of season 2 in 1. Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, good people of the jury, it is myself, Phil Taggart, and I've got Pete Doherty with me right now. How's it going?
Hello, Phil. Yeah, I'm all right. Thanks for having me. Lovely to be here.
Here we are in our Soho dungeon doing another podcast.
Bunkered in with my baby wipes and a cup of tea.
Yeah, what else could sort you out? Don't dunk the baby wipes into the tea. Biscuits will work a bit better.
No, they clog everything up, don't they?
How are you getting on? How's life?
Life's exciting at the moment. I've got a little solo project on the go to put in my J's, and we've made a record and we're putting out ourselves. And exciting is the right word because we're putting out ourselves.
Yeah, well, I think that's the first time you've done that. Like, you've put anything out, like DIY.
And it is, and it's the first time I've dug in and done the promo with enthusiasm and pleasure. And it's the first time I've actually got reviews where people actually seem to listen to the record, and I'm quite intrigued by the whole process now, as opposed to avoiding it. And
it's kind of, but the thing is, maybe like the way that the media were treating you around the records, like they were more interested in the circus around it rather than the music.
Shocking.
At that point.
Absolutely shocking. Yeah, they call it the English disease, don't they? Or was that football organism? No, it's this culture, isn't it? This celebrity culture where you're famous for being famous, and where a review of a record release can not include any mention of of the music. I mean, how dare the Daily Mail give me a good review? You know what I mean? After years of me putting out half decent music, some really good music, and they've never fucking reckoned me, and now they've given me 4 out of 5. I mean, shocking, you know? They support Oswald Mosley, don't forget.
Does that seem like some sort of like media redemption for you? Like them coming back and going, we're going to talk about the music?
It's very, very iffy, you know? It's like someone you've never trusted and has never made any secret of the fact that they don't like you, suddenly putting their arm around you in the pub and offering you, well, their wife and a line and a drink and whatever you want, mate. You know, what's mine is yours. Very dubious.
It's a wee bit. So we start every single podcast with a demo, like as early a demo as we can possibly dig out. And I've got one here from you. And I don't like listening to it until we're in the room together.
Get away.
Yeah, so I'm going to stick it on now. We've got this demo of yours, which is a demo of Can't Stand Me Now. Here it is.
Long intro vibe, yeah. Yeah. An enemy fitting for the start, they twisted and pulled our love apart. He said his life fingers through the dark, he shot in the lamp and into darkness cast. Oh no, you've got it the wrong way round. It took him out and down, corner good boy kicked outside the world. The world kicks back, I love fucking home. Stick with it, yeah. Teach me how to play guitar, smoke a cigarette like a superstar, and then a really dodgy line, something about a Wonder Bra. Yeah, so around. I read every review, they all prefer you.
Hearing that, it's like wearing your brother's like hand-me-down suit or school uniform, and then the one that went on the record is like, oh, I just got a brand new school uniform. That one's got the character. on it, and the other one does too. What was what went through your head for the first time when you heard that?
I realised the house next door to me is a brass house, and I seen all the girls, well, ladies, in their in school uniform on their fag break. Yeah. Like, but in their 30s, you know, but yeah, anyway.
And that's because like, there's lyrics in that track that never
it's,
made it
yeah,
onto
it's
the
like people
the
really say that song is a personal, like very personal account of like, you know, the what was going on with me and Carl. Well, that demo is like, you know, it's like the bits of your journal that you rip out,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
That bit about I read every review, they all prefer you. That was what was always, we were always arguing about that. If there was ever a review that, you know, we were in the early days.
But that,
we were so weird about fame. We'd read reviews and we'd get the name and address of the people that would give us bad reviews and go and see them. And then,
did you ever like deliver them? Like,
we've had like court orders put on us, yeah, from journalists and then on each other, really, I suppose, by the end. Yeah.
There was a real sense of elation when you were listening to that, like 20, 30 seconds and you had your eyes closed and it felt like you were like beamed back into the room when you were making that.
Yeah, it was strange hearing that, yeah. And I'm surprised, was it easy to find that?
I got sent it by your manager. But like, and he assures me, he's like, going, we've got the MP3, it's on Pete's iMac back in Margate, I'll go back and get it next week. you like, do you hold all the demos? Like, are you the gatekeeper of all of the music and memories?
Accidentally, yeah, it turns out to be so. That iCloud's amazing, you know, just when you think you've lost everything,
boom,
it's all there, you know, yeah. Everything, all your contacts, all your voice memos, and it's all about the voice memos, really, because you'd be sat. Even that, I think, was a recording of a recording in the end, because we lose an awful lot of things.
Yeah.
But there are reams of, yeah, just untitled files. And when you open them up, it's where someone's just left their iPhone in the rehearsal room or, you know, on the table on the bus. And it's, you hear, like, you know, germination of songs and, you know, late night conversations and a lot of late night jams. We think, what the f-? You know.
It must be good when you're like scrapping around to like go, right, do you know what, I need to make a record,
that's
I need
it.
To remember.
Yeah. No, that's it, you need to find someone who can edit and engineer
pull
and
it together.
Can see the beauty in the in the turd.
What do you remember like of that era, like that of writing that song? Do you remember when about that was? Was that like after Up the Bracket? Did you write that before, or was that like?
No, it was long after. Well, I say longer.
It was before, like before the second record, right?
Up the Bracket was ready to go when we got the deal with Rough Trade,
yeah,
and that was what the deal was about, really. Them songs, Up the Bracket, Time for Heroes, Boys in the Band, Begging, General Smuts,
Baseline and Vertigo,
Bangkok, Vertigo,
what a tune,
and they were all, yeah, they were written in kitchens in Hackney. And then Can't Stand Me Now was after we got signed, and you know, we had our own gaff, our own kitchen, like open plan sort of vibe.
It sounds probably more delightful than it probably was.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, no, it's
lovely open plan.
We got a record deal, we made sure we got all that in cash, and we used to iron it. We had it in the kitchen, in the fridge, and we'd iron it.
What, the cash that you got from Rough Trade?
Yeah.
How long did it last in the fridge for?
Oh no!
Did it move from fridge to fridge?
A couple of hours, like, yeah. No, we had a cool box as well. Yeah. No messing about. And Can't Stand Me Now came out of the split, didn't it? It was a song that we did after Alan McGee got the band back together after we'd fallen out, and that line in there in the single, it's your light fingers through the dark shattered the lamp. But and there it's from the Shelley poem, when the lamp is shattered and the light, and it says your light fingers through the dart that shattered the lamp, as opposed to a hand, you know, going through the shadowy alleyways and unlocking a window from the inside.
What was it like when you brought that to the band? Because like, obviously, like that, I always think about when people write songs, or like friends of mine write songs about love or breakups or whatever, I always think, what does their girlfriend think? But like what does the band think? If you're writing a song about a relationship with the band, do they turn up, go, oh my god, what a tune, this is amazing, shit, this is about me?
No, they always have the monitor with my voice in it down anyway, so yeah. They just like get stuck into the music and they get carried away, like, you know, where was I going to full on method mode quite happily. I think it's what it's all about, that moment when you bring songs like that to the band and you know it needs something else, you know. Like there's a bit in there missing where Gary does them.
Yeah.
You know?
It needs that.
It does need that. It needs a little trimming. And it needs to go on a little bit of a diet.
It's mad though, because like great music can be born out of people who don't even have a relationship. Like, I remember reading about Mick Jones and Joe Strummer, and how Joe Strummer would go around to Mick Jones' house and post his lyrics through the letterbox.
Right.
He wouldn't even say hello to him. He'd go, right, there's the song, you go write it.
Well, Joe Strummer just said that Mick Jones, at his worst, was like Elizabeth Taylor in a filthy mood. That's how he described him. And I think Morrissey and Mar worked in a similar way where they'd send a cassette or Mar would send the music. I just found that fascinating.
Yeah,
but
like,
that no one would know the lyrics until he turned up and did the take, Morrissey. And he'd only do it in one or two takes, apparently.
But that's what he, like, when he was on, he said that they wrote the pretty much the first album in like about four 2-hour sessions around each other's house. And they didn't speak about anything else other than the songs. And then they just left. That was it.
Yeah.
A pure, virtuous relationship.
Yeah. Same with Carl. It was very, very tense and difficult always. But when it came to writing the songs, we did it quickly, and you know, like an assassination.
It's bottling the lightning, isn't it?
Yeah, they were a good band and all. Yeah, and Ian Brown and John Squire, I think, did it by cassette, didn't they?
Yeah. I'm still waiting on that new Stone Roses album to come out. I think we'll be waiting a long, long, long time.
Yeah, and it won't have a drum machine.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you about, like as a Northern Irish person, you spent some time in Lisburn, right, when you were growing up?
I did. I lived at 111 Mount View Drive, County Antrim. Yeah, 3.5 years I was there, actually, in the early to mid-80s.
I was going to say, what age?
I think I went there when I was 5 and left when I was 8.
Did you move back to England with a strong Northern Irish accent?
No, my little sister was born there, though.
Yeah.
But my little sister was born in Belfast, and we went from there, which was, as you can imagine, like, you know yourself, Northern Ireland in the 80s was
pretty rough.
It was a different place to. But when we went from there to Cyprus, where it was like, you know, so hot, they didn't even send you to school anyway. There wasn't a school really for the army kids, and also being an army kid in Northern Ireland.
That's strange as well, because like you're like an army kid, like your dad worked in the army, but you're an Irish Catholic. You're a Catholic, but with Irish relatives?
Well, my father came from an Irish Catholic background in Paddington, and him joining the army was, I think, the biggest two fingers up we could have given to.
A done deal back in like when your dad would have joined the army. Like it was like for.
In '68, like he just decided he was either going to, like, if he stayed in London, he was going to go to jail and not from, you know. And when I talked to him about the 60s and said, I must have been great in the mods, and he said, no, it was really hard. You know, really, like, pissed on my dreams there, actually, in the 60s. He said it was horrible. So he fancied himself as a Marine, went to join. The Marines were closed,
yeah,
but the Army office was open down Piccadilly. And then next minute, he's on train to Aldershot, and he never looked back. But, yeah, a lot of his mates went the other way, if you know what I mean.
That's what happens.
Completely the other way. Like, and in fact, yeah, some interesting...
People get sent to the Army to sort of straighten them out. Like, in America, it's like, oh my God, my kid got a B in his test. I'm going to send him to military school.
Yeah. Well, it used to be like it was the only way out of prison, you know, that you could join the army, you know, traditionally. Like,
yeah.
Tommy Atkins, isn't it? Tommy this and Tommy that.
Was there much music?
And kick him out, the brute. But it's thank you, Mr. Atkins, when the guns begin to shoot. There was music because my dad, I remember, gave me a guitar when we lived there, and I didn't really, it's like the Chaz and Dave song where he looks at it and doesn't know what to do, so he starts thumping it. And then just carries on strumming. And, yeah, there's a guitar knocking about the house. And I remember there were these, I don't know if maybe you're a bit younger than me, but there were these travelling street performers, and all the kids would sit in a circle on the grass, and these fellas would have painted faces, and they'd do plays, you know, for the community.
Yeah, I think that's, is that called the Mummers or something like that?
Yeah. And I remember them having a guitar and asking for a volunteer. And he put his hands around from the back of me, right? And did the chords, and I strum it, and you know what, I've only just thought of that after all these years. I wonder if that's true. That's a true story.
Yeah, so it's like I've thought, like, sometimes I get my sort of own imagination mixed up with the rest of it, you know.
Go on, give us one of your myths.
One of my myths. There's one, right, that I've got, and I've told the story so many times that I can't remember if it's true or not. And I went to see Shane McGowan and the Popes. Right, it wasn't the Pogues. The Popes were referred to, maybe unfairly, as his drinking band, right? Which is saying a lot. But I think I was first year of university. And we went down to a place called Tombridge, just outside of Derry. And there was a band called the Rednecks that were supporting, right? So you can kind of picture the spit and sawdust environment of it.
Tin trays bouncing.
There's no barrier around at all. He comes out and he's swaying on his stool and he's in bad nick, right? And we're a little bit pissed off and we're in bad nick too. But we're like, right, do you know what? Fuck this. Like, we've paid our money. We want to see Shane McGowan. You got to play. So he's drinking a bottle of white wine, Gato Negro. Is that his...
Out of a pint glass.
Yeah, that's the name of his, like, the wine he was drinking. And so I just grabbed it from the stage and pinned it in front of him and passed it to my mate. And he just suddenly just, like, woke up out of a stupor, grabbed the heavy bottom-ended mic stand and then tried stabbing it into the crowd. And we were, like, ducking and diving. We managed to get away with it. And then I tried to go backstage to get him to sign it later on. My friends tried to drag me away saying he'd smash it over my head if he seen me. So that's one of the ones where I know that like three quarters of it's true, but I'm not sure if I've just like, if I fixed the narrative to make it a better story.
I remember he came up to me once and he said, "Congratulations, you're now the most obnoxious man in pop."
That must have been, like, what do you say when Shane McGowan like passes you the baton like that?
I don't know, you just beam, I suppose, and like, I don't know. I'd be proud of that. Yeah, passes you the baton.
When I came over to London for the first time as an adult, the one place that I wanted to visit, we were coming over to see Blur. I think we were like 17 or 18, and I took three of my friends to go to a place called Filthy McNasty's. And the reason I wanted to go to Filthy McNasty's is because you guys had played your early shows there.
Yeah,
I wanted to sort of go and soak in the very early days of the Libertines.
I think it might have changed a bit.
Yeah. No, but this wasn't like this was a while ago. It was still it was just the year before it closed down.
All right.
And I was just wondering. I was looking at a small pub and I was just wondering, like, this is where it all really began, isn't it?
Yeah, Arcadian Cabaret Nights at Filthy McNasty's. Yeah, me and Rabbi John, pulling pints and ducking and diving and trying to get the band to turn up. It used to be the Fountain, that pub, before it became Filthy's, and it was the worst pub in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you remember the sign, the silhouette of a fellow with a massive uta and a fedora?
Yeah.
It says, "Here comes a regular." Yeah. There were a few grand regulars there.
It was like the early iteration of the band. Like, was that when Johnny Burrell was in the group? He was in it for a while, wasn't he?
He rehearsed with us twice. And
is that it? Like, that was
listen, right? He was supposed to play bass for us the night that we were doing the Rough Trade Showcase, and he phoned and said, "I can't show up, but I'm living the dream in Cardiff with the Alabama Free." We were like, "What the fuck? We're playing. We've got the fucking showcase tonight." So me and Carl had to swap guitar and bass between songs, and that was kind of like we got signed, but.
You got signed regardless because the tunes were good, but like...
Right, but that was the first night that Endicott, you know, appeared like a sweaty angel there with his anecdotes about Julian Casablancas and his Converse.
This is your A&R man from Rough Trade?
Right. I'm not going to go into all that anyway.
Yeah.
I want to tell you a story about Derry.
We
pulled up there in a bus and I thought, right, yeah, but like, these are my people. So I stopped my head out the top of the tour bus and...
Is this with Baby Shambles Libertines?
It was Baby Shambles, yeah. No, I never went.
I don't think you went with the Libertines, but I know you went with Baby Shambles.
No, I never went.
I think I was at all those shows, so I can probably remember them pretty well.
Someone shouted, "Duck and eat your plum bag," and a bottle came flying over and smashed on the end of the guitar. And after that, I was just like poking the guitar at the top and then, pulling it in as the bottles came. And then they all expected to get on the guest list. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, like, not a lot of bands would tour through Derry at that time. So, like, that was that was them showing affection. It was everybody so riled up and excited that something's coming through town that they don't know how to control
themselves.
I felt
the affection. I did.
What was the first guitar that you actually learned to play that you were like going, "This is mine. I love this guitar."
All right. I thought it was a huge FL Gibson, but. And everyone knew it was. And everyone knew it was an Indian copy and it was a V, not a B, but done to look like a B. It was a Gibson, right? That I got for 30 quid. And my pride and joy, and I customised it. But, yeah, I think someone did put me out of misery. It's not a Gibson, Pete. What? It's a Gibson. Like when Scarborough Steve, the original Libertine singer, told me he'd written all these Arthur Lee and Love songs who I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
And so I was going around playing them to people saying, listen to this new tune we got. You know, Alone Again or House Is Not a Motel, signed yeah. DC. And they're just looking at me like, and no one would tell me. Up until I said, right, we've got to do these songs tonight. And they're like, Pete, come here. And I sit down. Like, they're not Steve songs.
And you just had no idea?
Well,
how
no,
old were you?
It was a gap in my education, 18.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's perfectly fine not to...
Yeah, I never listened to Arthur Lee and Love.
I mean, that could have been tragic. If you had turned up to record them at the album, and you're like going, oh, I've got all these really good songs. This one's called My Old Man's Dustman. My friend wrote it, but we're going to record it. what was the first record that, like, you, like, hugged, and you were just like, this is my record, I love this, this is a bit of me?
The one that I played off the spool was Derek B, Bullet From A Gun. That was when I was in Cyprus, actually. I had it on cassette, so it must have been 86. It was all about bootleg cassettes then. Def Leppard, Hysteria, Derek B, Bullet From A Gun, and my mum took the Def Leppard Hysteria. She said it was satanic.
That means it's even better, right? Like if you're young and your mum says something's bad, you're like, oh, I'm going to listen to
this. There's this like cupboard of doom with all these things, like satanic Cabbage Patch Dolls, Def Leppard records, skateboards, you know?
My granny used to make me turn over Neighbours because it was... was it immoral?
Yeah.
It was on a half five before The Simpsons.
Grange Hill. I wasn't allowed to watch Grange Hill, for fuck's sake, eh?
There's no like, no wonder you rebelled.
No, do you know what I mean?
What chance did you couldn't even have a Cabbage Patch doll.
There's a lesson there somewhere.
Yeah, let the children run free.
Let the children boogie.
Like you were talking about, like you were 18 when you didn't know that song from Arthur Lee, but one song, one album, and one band you did know is Oasis, because like that video clip keeps to reappearing every once in a while if you like standing outside the record shop.
I know. I want to clear this one up. Okay,
go on.
Working in the Trocadero Centre. Okay, demonstrating wind-up frogs, okay? And I knew that there was something going on because all these TV cameras and photographers, and there was a giant cardboard cutout of Noel and Liam. So I went down there. I just wanted to get on the telly. Joined the queue, grabbed the cardboard cutouts, was doing these, like, stupid, like, you know, please photograph me things, jumping on the back of an open-top bus with these cardboard cutouts, and then next morning run into the news agents thinking I was going to be on... It's going to be me on the front of the paper with these couple of cows. But
yeah.
I wasn't queuing for Oasis. My sister was a big Oasis fan. And I later tuned in to them and decided they were brilliant. But at the time, I was far more interested in that. Getting photographed on the back of a bus with a cardboard cutout.
Yeah, but you went on, like, you came out with the line, I've written it down, that Umberto, you subscribe to the Umberto eco view that Noel Gallagher is the poet and Liam is the town crier.
Cracking line,
though. Perfect
huh?
combination. A fucking great line.
Where'd that come from?
Yeah.
Belter.
That's what I'm saying. It's like.
More me.
To come off that off the top of your head, like the guy was just like, have you thought about being a presenter? And then I was like, God, could you imagine you and Russell Brand as being presenters around the same time?
Jesus.
It would have been too much. There would have been too much back coming.
Oh, nasty! Is that like a sexual thing? Back combing?
No, it's like when you make your hair all big.
Oh, right, back combing.
Yeah,
right.
Bat
combing.
When you like, obviously, you got like a flair, like you like an incredible flair, even at that age for the written word. Who were like the poets that you were listening to like around that time? Dumbass here.
I was consuming everything at that age. It was just really like my world. I didn't reckon much really to society or what was around me, and it was where I wanted to be, you know, everything.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I mean, I think if you do write about things with enough passion and concentration on the rhyming scheme, they do actually happen. But at the time, I didn't know anything about foreign girls or London at 4 a.m, you know, going out to find it. But I think Jack Kerouac, I was picking up him, and
that's a rite of passage, Kerouac and Bukowski and stuff like that, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I think Bukowski came a little bit late. I was quite clean, shall we say, you know what I mean? It was all more about adventure and travel and people, not so much about experimenting or getting lost in a substance, which, you know, I kind of took to like a duck to water. But at the time I was completely, you know, yeah, I didn't even smoke.
Yeah, I was going to say, you probably couldn't imagine like even going out and drinking too much, or end up
I didn't. No, I didn't know what drugs were, really.
What switched it? Was it literature? Like, was it the access of the authors and stuff that you were reading about? Because like that stuff can be quite romantic to
I fell into a bit of a trance actually with this idea of opium and what it could do, and I think the difference between opium in its purest form and skag, I didn't really see it. I completely romanticised it and the world, and threw myself in with a rare energy. And I also had a bit of trouble sleeping at that time, and I found it was helping me to sleep, you know. I was working at Filthy's late shifts and early shifts and opening the place, and I suddenly discovered like an easy way to get a bit of shut-eye and incredible dreams. That's a really good point, actually, yeah.
Was that around the time when Libertine started?
Like
late 90s?
99, 2000.
Yeah, because it says on Wikipedia, right? And Wikipedia can be right sometimes and not wrong sometimes.
It said my middle name's Daniel. Listen, I've logged in, I've changed it. My middle name is not Daniel. They've put it back. I don't have a middle name. It's just like that, Peter Duncan.
I don't have a middle name, either. Right. My mum said it was a waste of time.
Right. What were you going to be if you were a girl?
I don't know. I think they knew I was a dude.
Eve, I was going to be.
Eve? Yeah. Eve Doherty?
Yeah.
That's a very Irish name. Pete Doherty's pretty Irish, but Eve Doherty, like you know, I feel like I've been to your show.
Yeah, I feel like I've been to my show.
Yeah. So like it says here on Wikipedia it starts in 97, but then the debut album doesn't come out to 2002. So like what the fuck was happening in the first 5 years, just figuring it all out? Did you have management? Did you write songs?
Figuring it all out, and then it all unraveling, and yeah, we did. We had songs, but they were ballads really. And then Banny, who was our management, she clocked the strokes and was like, "Look, they're wearing the same clothes as you, but if you don't notice, they're playing a lot faster." You know, and getting a lot more out of the industry. Speed the fucking songs up a bit. And we did. Time for Heroes was like a photo. It was like, "There you see the stylish kids in the riot."
Yeah.
Up like muck. Now that'd be a demo to get hold of.
Yeah, see, that sounds like Scarborough Fair. And then it's because somebody said that Carl had never even listened to The Clash, so that makes me think that like punk rock wasn't really that important to you, that it just came naturally.
It did. The whole spirit was in the end what we became. We was just, by the end of it, those 5 years, we were just fucking angry, just pissed off and homeless and yeah.
You're not gonna make mainstream killers esque records when you're living that lifestyle, right?
Well, that's when you are, isn't it? That's when you put everything into it, or you know, that's when you knock it on the head and get on with trying to find your place in the cogs and that.
So was that like Strokes came out in 2001? I think I was like just leaving primary school around that stage, and the formative record for me was like the Strokes 2001, Jimmy Eat World, Bleed America, which came out in 2001, and then your record Up the Bracket, which came out in 2002. I can't remember a time since then that's been as important for UK guitar music. Like Britpop was only around the corner, so like Britpop had only sort of died off a couple of years, so like the guitar music was still really important. But then when in 2002 you guys kicked off and kicked off a whole like basically 7-8 years of like really a real golden period for music with guitars in the UK. Mm-hmm. And it was just because somebody came around and goes, those songs are great, speed them up the fuck.
Yeah, they're always out there, aren't they? It's like in England there's always lads out there and lasses getting bands together, you know, probably by the millions, and then the media will decide to shine a spotlight in a certain direction. But there's untold talent out there. It's just, you know, this
waiting to be discovered.
Yeah. Who is hungry enough to fucking get in the cannon and get shot up there?
Well, that's it. Like, would you recommend it to your, like, to your son or to your cousin or to somebody else? Like, if they're starting out, if your son's picking up guitar, like, or whatever, a steel, would you go?
Take the baton. Someone take the baton. It's like, I'm weary now.
Is it like a lifestyle that you would have chose again?
Well, I don't think I've really changed that much, to be honest. Yeah.
I don't feel any different than I am than I was 16, apart from I'm a little bit fatter and I've got like a mortgage now.
Yeah. And I still haven't listened to Beer Now, like, you know? And I'm still working my way through Foucault's Pendulum. That's Umberto Eco book, by the way, which I haven't read, but it's sat there on the shelf. I must read it one day.
Do you reckon that the sales of military jackets in Camden for 10 years went through the roof for about, maybe like through the roof by about 1,000%?
No, they got their money back because we were awful, stealing things all the while. And yeah, we weren't allowed in any of them guitar shops, Denmark Street. The day we got signed, we were straight back, and all the people that we bought guitars off. And
I remember the video for...
I remember putting on a military jacket and legging it. It was amazing. It was a blue one with amazing buttons, French military, and legging it down Portobello, being chased by the storeholder who had a vintage, like, Boer War spear. That missed it.
Sounds like Game of Thrones.
Me. Yeah, honestly, you wouldn't even believe it.
I when I was 14, I had a military jacket. I'm an Irish Catholic who lived in Omagh, and I went out in the summertime.
A red coat?
I was blue. It was a blue one. It was kind of like a mixture between your one and the one Julian Casablancas would wear.
That was a cracker one.
Yeah, it was pretty good. So don't fit into it anymore. But walking about a town in Northern Ireland with a military jacket on got me into a couple more scuffs and a couple more broken noses than I probably deserved or needed.
Yeah, man, broke you in.
Yeah, but that's it. Like, and I wasn't quite sure whether it was Nicky Wire, whether it was you, or whether it was the Strokes, but compounding you together in this one like military jacket, going, I would do it again. It was worth it.
You had a stencil on it then?
Huh?
You had a stencil?
I didn't have a stencil on this one because it was too nice. I didn't like. I wasn't a proper punk. I wasn't willing to put Tippex on it. If I didn't like it, there was Tippex all over it, like my Converse. We just have like, you know, fuck you or something like written on the side of it.
Put the boot in.
That's what you gotta do at that age. So recording the first album, Up the Bracket, who recorded that with you? Was that like, did you do that with like, who was the producer?
That's a really, I've got this image now, you walk around in a military jacket,
yeah,
and kids everywhere walking around, and there was something in the Julian Casablancas lyric about, it was an honest man, asked me for the phone, tried to take control, and for me that was about standing up to someone who's trying to mug you, and it was a real turnaround for me, just that, like, rather than hold on to your phone and legging it, hey, no, you're not having my phone. You got, you know, I'm going to fight you for my phone. And it was Mick Jones that produced the record, yeah.
I want to go back now.
Yeah, go on.
Did you have a relationship with them, the Strokes, around that time? Did you cross paths?
I was working at Filthy's, and...
Because I know you just had a relationship with Adam Green.
My first love was this girl called Francesca. She was stunning. She used to wear these black and yellow knee-length socks, and she said, "I'm just going up to Sainsbury's." Right? And when she got back, she'd been ages. I said, "Where the fuck have you been?" She said, "I met these five New York lads from a band. They're all wearing like these really cool leather jackets." And I was like, "What the fuck?" And they told me that. They invited me to their gig, and I went, "Yeah." And I said, "Come, my boyfriend, come too." And they said, "Can you get us any acid?" And she said, "Can you?" I said, so I took that first night at Heaven. I'd never seen anything like it. I didn't even know it could still happen. And I knew that they'd all drop tabs as well. And to see him like up there in the dark, no lights, and all these... It was just everyone just like lost in this madness mosh pit. And there was no mix. It was just this quagmire of music. And everyone was just having it. And I thought, shit, it can still fucking happen. It was like being, I don't know, in the Cop, you know, in the late 70s. Or it was what I'd always wanted to see and feel. And it gave us all injection of life. And yeah, I was curious about him. And when we ended up getting signed to Rough Trade and we went on tour with him, I tried to communicate with him, but he was very odd. He just came up to me and I can't remember what he said, but he's saying, they weren't, yeah. "You were, what did he say to me? You're not Brazilian, get out of my way," or something like that.
Maybe he's a big fan of Brazilian football or something.
I had decided my lovely little tin, right? I was really proud of my little tin, you know, and he just sniffed all the coke out of it and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, did I do all your cocaine?" And then my mate Alan Ross had a big scrap with their security and they said, "Listen, man, why do you like to hang out with people who like to fight? It's not cool." And, I thought they were wicked, but all my friends at that time, including Carl, actually, resented them.
What, because they were so
because
good?
They were good and popular, and like, I was like, no, let's enjoy it. And then we're there. I'm at Brixton Academy one time, fucking ready for the gig, really excited. And Alan, who's under there, like going, this is shit, we're much better than this. And I'm like, oh, fucking hell, fellas.
But,
you know?
But that's kind of like, that's part of the course of being in a band. I was in a band for 9 years, and we used to like look at any band that was on above us going, oh, what the fuck are they doing on above us?
Occasionally, someone comes along with tunes that you need them.
Like Someday or like Reptilia. I mean, the whole first album's just incredible.
Yeah, hard to explain.
You see, the thing with the Libertines is like you've got three
right. Call to Arms. It was a Call to Arms completely. Like the fact they went to private school and all that didn't matter. And their security were massive anyway. You're never going to get anywhere with all them big Australian lads. Left hand got proper bounced. You know? Yeah, proper bounce.
But then that started happening with you. So like when like, you know, as foresight as that was, like in literally a year and 18 months maybe later, the same thing was happening with you guys. Like you were playing pretty big gigs. People wanted to come. There was a Pete Doherty in the crowd looking at you who
exactly.
went out and started a band.
Exactly. Yeah? And that was really what I was writing about. Climbing inside analysis of yourself up your own Harris, basically lost in this fame that you craved for so long, you know. And maybe you suddenly, because I always thought, oh, I just know what I don't want to talk about all that, because it's a bit,
there's a bit
weird saying, right, Morrissey was famous by the time he was 23, I got to be famous by the time he was 3, and then
it's good to have those parameters, like, you know. Like, the Beatles had written how many albums by the time they were, like, 25? The Smiths had started and finished in, like, 6 years.
And you really feel it as well then, yeah. At that time.
Yeah, like, there's nothing... Nobody puts as much pressure on you as you do yourself. No. And around about that time, it probably forced you into writing the songs that got you to where the initial part of the Libertines started. Plus the fact you probably just want to be better than people as well, do you know? Like, that's a big thing.
Yeah, taking the... best songs are just reversing the chord progression and open for the best. Like,
yeah. So what was like, how, what was the point where you were like going, fuck, this is kicking off? Like, we're not just a first on at the Camden Assembly or whatever. Like
that moment at Heaven when I felt that surge and everyone was together. It was like, it happened in Liverpool as well and it was just gangs of lads in Reebok Classics getting into this band, and then we went off and we got signed and all that, but we didn't. It wasn't until we, so that was what we wanted. We wanted the surge. We wanted to score a goal at the Loft End and see the crowd go mental. But for a while, it was people with folded arms who'd seen the hype and were like, "Well, come on then,
impress me."
But then I think it was Sheffield Leadmill when they had to turn the hoses like on the crowd because they were going so mental. It was the first time I seen a mosh pit. I remember we started a horror show. We'd been in Scandinavia playing to the folded arms in the tiny places. And we did the Leadmill, the album come out, people knew the songs before coming to the gig for the first time, and bang, that was it. And apparently that night, the Arctic Monkeys formed as well. They all met there at that gig.
At that gig?
And the other lot, Milburn, were all there. And I don't know if they'll admit it now.
So that,
they,
so like...
they were all in their red jackets in the crowd. But then they switched and were like, "Nah, you're shit, we're better."
And, you passed the bat on before you'd even like.
No, I didn't know. I dropped it.
You didn't even.
I was fine. I thought I was well away.
But like that.
But we looked up and looked at each other during our show, and down it, and it was like, "Yeah, this is it. Let's have it." And we just went with it and wrote it until. You can't stay away for 72 days. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, totally. So like. What was your relationship with like the Arctic Monkeys when you seen that popping off? Because that must have been like, your gig must have been like Manchester Free Trade Hall.
Thank
in, like,
you.
The
I didn't
70s.
Want to say that, but yeah.
So like when the gig where Sex Pistols played and what was it like? Joy Division formed and the Buzzcocks formed and somebody told me like Mick Hucknall was there, which I find hilarious.
Yeah.
So that was your gig. That was your free trade.
Yeah, the Grundies of Kibibble, when these filthy pants fell out of the back of the tour bus, and then this really fit tour manager, she held them up and went, "Whose are these?" And Carl was like, "The Pete's." It was a horrible moment. Awful. That was that day, and something else then as well. Oh no, the Arctic Monkeys. I just refused to listen to them, and managed to avoid them for a long, long time, and now. Sometimes you no matter how I try, because I heard they were good, so I didn't want to listen to them.
Yeah,
you don't listen to anyone good. I decided I don't know. And then there was a few things that happened where I didn't know, I didn't know them by sight, and they'd come to say hello, and I had them slung out or something. And then when I tried to go and say hello, they stabbed me. I wasn't allowed to go and anywhere near there backstage.
Oh shit! So like,
I still haven't met them.
Kind of like comedy of errors, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a bit. I don't know that fella. He's I suppose he's a good songwriter, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Like, you can't.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to be in a relationship with him, though. He really fucking pulls him apart in them songs, the ones I've heard. There's a few embarrassed girls out there, I tell you now.
What about the songs you write? Surely you've been like, come on, like when you finish your relationship with Kate Moss.
You
must have got some serious amount of music out of that, right?
No, I don't really. I always change the names and
Just do with the Stone Roses and Oasis do and call them Sally.
I did. Well, what Katie did was what Sally did.
What Sally did.
And then it was what Lucy did. I gave a lot of people a home break when that song came out. A lot of people got off lightly for things that, like, unforgivable things. You burn someone's teddy bear.
Huh? Who burnt your teddy bear? I got asked now. You,
well, it wasn't Sally and it wasn't Lucy.
So, all right. Well, I'll keep an eye out for
Pandy. Keep an eye out for Pandy.
For Pandy,
a black and white one-eyed teddy bear with a Kylie Minogue transfer on the back of his head from a Smash Hits issue 1987.
If there's an arsonist out there called Katie, we know what you've done.
Apparently, he got burnt.
So the second record, The Libertines, so much shit kicked off in between that like it must have been difficult to even record that record. I was glued to NME every single week, but in Oma we used to get NME a week later than everybody else, so I was always a week behind the times.
First day of recording, I was a week behind the times myself, mate. Yeah. Trust me, a week. The first day of recording, we went in and we recorded about 14 songs, bang. And then we sat down and had some lunch, and then I can't remember what was said. He said something about the burglary, and then I've gone for him, because by this time I've been to prison and I'm not scared of him anymore after all these years. And his hand grabs me by the back of the shirt as I've gone for him and I've gone across the glass table, and I didn't even know Alan McGee had these two 6'4" Maori twins positioned, and then that was it. I didn't go back to the studio, but it didn't matter because they
had your bits.
These songs, I didn't go back.
And did you do that in one day?
I think it was a couple of days.
Couple of days.
14 songs, and it was all sort of like, if you listen to Can't Stand Me Now, it starts off with the end of one take and crashes straight in. It like the what's his name? Jonathan Ross. The Jonathan Ross version of Can't Stand Me Now.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. That band that we were was, yeah, we were capable. And Mick Jones caught it and that was it. I didn't really go back in, I think.
So, like, was it hard when you went?
It's heartbreaking. I'd get there in the morning and just sort of get to the door and then turn around because it was going to be murders.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's probably best to take yourself out of the equation if it's going to happen like that. And then, I mean, Baby Shambles and Dirty Pretty Things, basically, like, after the album came out.
And I found a new friend anyway. Fracking heroin.
Baby Shambles.
Fracking heroin.
It felt heroin. But, like, is that when it...
Can you just say that? Because I've been doing, like, that in a Northern Irish accent for years.
Fucking heroin?
No, cracking heroin.
Cracking heroin.
That's amazing.
There you go.
You give me, like,
is that when it, like, really kicked off? Because obviously you were, like, in pain after the breakup, right?
But there seems to be all sunny days in my memory. And I get quite turned on by the rain, you know? The sun was, like, a bit of a struggle. The bloody sun.
What's it like now? Because obviously you've been on, off. You don't have to answer it if you don't want to.
Okay.
That's totally fine.
Yeah.
I'm not here to push that sort of shit. Like, Baby Shambles, right? You're sitting and you're chatting with you're chatting to a whole new band. I know I've met Drew a couple of times before, who's your bass player. I think I chased him into a bakery one day because I met him a couple of times. I DJed with him once. And I was like, hello. And he turned around, shocked, going, like, oh, God, who the fuck are you? And I was like, oh, shit, he doesn't recognize me. I was like, all right, pure awkward. But Drew is such a level bass player. And, like, with the Libertines, John is such a level bass player. Like, you have to have a level bass player. I'm a bass player, but I don't feel too level, but that's why I'm not in the band anymore.
John started to move, though. He started tapping his foot and moving his head a lot more. Yeah.
He's got that sort of pigeon head going on.
You're calling John a pigeon head?
I don't know, all bass players have got it. That just means bopping.
I see what you mean, yeah. Goo.
Yeah.
Goo.
You just bop it.
He's a mean bass player, that John Hassell.
He really is.
Don't know what to say about Drew, man. He's gone to play for Liam Gallagher. Right.
How do you feel about Liam nicking your bass player?
I think we should have a sponsored boxing match and the loser gets Drew.
Dude, Liam Gallagher goes out running every single day. Do you think you're going to have the cardio that Liam Gallagher's got? Well, I don't have the cardio.
Listen,
I'm like 15 years younger than him.
I'll weigh him in, mate. I'll weigh him in.
I mean, do you know what? I would pay.
This is it. No, people would, wouldn't they? People would, though.
I would pay a lot of money to see that.
We can make a fortune for ourselves, for good causes. Like, it'd be a great idea. And yes, he does go jogging every day. And, you know,
just for the trash talk alone, like, can you imagine the 3-4 weeks lead into that?
Yeah, I'd have to find myself a sparring partner. Who am I going to find, a Mancunian with size 3 feet to spar with?
But the thing is, you're taller than he is. Like, you're like, what, 6'5", 6'4"?
No, I'm not 6'4", Jesus Christ.
Well, you're tall, man.
6'3" and a half.
That was the hat.
6'1". I'm 6'1" and a half. Last time I got arrested, I was 6'1" and a half. And he offered me out once. I heard that. It was at Kentishtown Forum.
Who, Liam?
Yeah, he said, Liam Gallagher's downstairs. He said he's going to kick your head in. So I went down and spoke to him. I said, Liam, we were right, aren't we? He went, yeah, we're right, man. Fucking, yeah, you're a puppet, I'm a puppet. Fucking hell. And that was the end of it.
That was it?
Yeah, I was very disappointed.
You called his bluff?
I don't know. Maybe someone was just stirring.
Well, he's been in a lot of fights. Remember,
he got his teeth knocked out
in Germany or something like that?
It was in Milan, I think.
Was it Milan?
Yeah,
I'm not saying
giving it the big one, right? Slag off Liam Gallagher. There was an occasion, and, you know, 9 out of 10 of my friends, I got 10 friends, laugh at this when I tell them it. But once at the V Festival, there was an inflatable penis in the crowd, and he said to the whole crowd, "Glad to see Pete Docker. He could make it today." So I owe him one. No, he needs a slap. Yeah.
I've never heard that before. That's amazing. I swear to God, I can't get the fuck. I can't do the rest of this interview now because I can't get the pay per view idea out of my head now. I'm just like thinking of like Joe Rogan commenting on it and all the rest of it.
It could work.
Pete's actually a master of Muay Thai striking. He's an incredible striker, whereas Liam has a trash talk.
Cage fight.
Somebody told me that Carl, your Libertines co-host, is a big fan of cage fighting. UFC.
He's been training for a while now at the old mixed martial arts thing in Stoke Newington. He goes with his boys. I think he's actually building an army, you know, Carly. He always used to talk about that. He did. So he's got all these kids now and he's training them up, mate. Yeah.
Well, he started the revolution when he was 18, and now he's figured out there's a different way to do the revolution, and it's by starting an army.
Yeah, there's different ways to move.
What was it like when you sort of like reunited? I did an interview with you guys around about that time in Scotland in the Glen Eagles Hotel, and I was very nervous because I was obviously a big fan, and it was around about tea in the park, I think, and it was so odd to be in the room with like a band that was coming back together. Like how did that feel for you around that time?
It was overexcited, I think, to be honest. We had a few new songs on the boil, like Fame and Fortune. I think we tried it for the first time that day.
Your headline set.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in typical Libertines fashion, it's like
we probably ballsed it up actually. Yeah.
But that's all right. When you've got a drummer like Gary and you've got a bass player like John.
Yeah, no, the review said this new song's got a really interesting intro, but we all got it out of time. But, yeah.
So when you got back together, was it like, I kind of imagined some sort of like the sofa in Oprah, and somebody would come out and be like, "Well, we've got your long lost friend Carl here," and everybody's crying and hugging. And
you thought you're never going to see him again. Well, surprise, surprise, you're getting deported tomorrow.
It's still a black sort of
reunification, getting back together. You know?
Was it emotional or was it just like, let's get back to this? Fuck's sake.
We're still trying to work out what to do. You know, turns out Gary and John have got all these songs, and we've forgotten how to write. So we've got all these great songs, but Gary and John's, you know.
Yeah, but you haven't forgotten to write. You've got a record that's coming out.
Oh no,
tomorrow.
No, you're right. Yeah, no, you're right. We just need to get in the same room. So. He's been coming down to Margate where we have a studio now, Libertine Studio.
Is it a studio now?
It's a studio. It's finished. The studio's finished. It's great.
But, like, wasn't it meant? Isn't it a hotel as well?
It's a hotel upstairs, but the ground floor is now a studio where it was the massage part, the sauna and all that. And now Carl's got his liquor license. And so we're having the Wastelands bar downstairs. But yeah, we've had a few sessions. The guy from The Prodigy come down a couple of weeks ago and he's been demoing for us, like getting us together and taking ideas and
is that like in a sort of engineer capacity, or is he going to put some jungle beats on it?
Well, no, producing that, he's going to do what he does. Yeah, no, Carl turned up with these. He said, right, I've got this drum beat. It's a bit like the Beastie Boys. I never really listened to the Beastie Boys. Me and you are going to go in the booth and we're just going to spit some bars. Pit. I said, we're going to what? So bear in mind, when I was 8, I had this Derek B record that I listened to again. No one knows any of Derek B's rhymes.
Yeah.
I've got them all up there, right? So I was coming out of these amazing fucking lines. And we were like, wow, what's that? I was like, I don't know, it just came out. So now that he's edited them and... Yeah.
You're going to get a lawsuit from Derek B?
He's dead.
Yeah. His estate.
Died potless as well.
So, like, the idea for... Like, I mean, most people... When they heard the Libertines were opening a hotel in Margate, we're like, fucking hell, what's this going to be like? But it seems like it's all like above board, legit, a proper hotel.
Have a look at it. Have a look what I mean.
I know, I've seen. I watched a Channel 4 interview and they did like a show around it. It looked proper.
The fella that did painted Carl's house, that guy, I forget his name. He's a dogger. He's painted it black and gold outside, and it looks incredible. It looks incredible, and yeah, Libertines Hotel. I was going to call it Hotel the King. But everyone thinks that's a terrible title.
What is it, Hotel the King?
No, it's not, but that's what I wanted to
go. Hotel the King would...
Hotel the King of Rock and Roll?
Yeah. Hotel the King would be a good name for about like a year, and then you'd be like, going, oh, God, I have to call it Hotel the King.
Yeah, no, then you just take the King off it, and it's just Hotel. Yeah. But I've seen that all the thing, because it got voted the worst hotel in the southeast of England.
That was before you bought it?
Oh yeah, no, of course. Yeah,
well, that means there's nowhere to go but up.
Well, yeah, but no, people can be cruel.
Yeah?
Yeah, no, that lady, she just didn't suffer fools gladly. You know, someone would complain about finding spunk on the pillow and she'd just kick them out.
To be fair, if I found spunk on my pillow, I probably would complain as well. It wouldn't be a very good review on Airbnb.
Spunk on their pillow, though. Who's going to even admit to that? It's obviously a joke. I remember in rehab once, this girl caused a big scene. So someone's wanked off in my toilet and everyone had to go to a bathroom and I was like, that's shampoo. You know what I mean? Someone had come and squirt it get to the bottom of these things, you man. Just like never Columbo.
Know. I know.
Send Columbo in.
I get my lowest.
My wife's a big fan of your shampoo.
And we get my lowest rating yet, 4 out of 5. So the Puta Madres, how do you get them together? How did it come together? Is it a Margate thing?
No. It is a Floresta thing, actually. Yeah, it was born in Barcelona's Floresta, this band, with me and Rafa, the drummer. And hence the symbol for the band, which is the Javali.
You got your guitar with you.
About when Jesus kills the pig, or not Jesus, someone kills the pig. But the symbol of the band is the Javali because they're everywhere in the Floresta and they're a protected species.
Yeah.
It's not religious.
It's like that's a deep symbol, and then the name of the band brings it back down to its base quality, isn't it? Puta Madres means
motherfuckers, I suppose. Mother, yeah. Or the mother of the whore, but I didn't know it meant that. You know, he just said it all the time.
Yeah.
When he was happy and when he was disappointed, yeah, it's the Puta Madre. Well, what's happening? Today I am the Puta Madre, eh? So, and everybody says it. Like, they got some weird curse words in Spanish. You know, they say, God, no, was it? I shit on God and I shit in the milk and I shit in the sea. It's like, and that's
is that like it's just
away,
bad translations?
No, swear words that men, women, and children use.
There's a track on the record, or I assume it's on the record, but it's a single because I haven't got the album yet. It's called Paradise Is Under Your Nose.
Aye.
What a beautiful track.
Nice.
What an amazing track. I listened to it 4 times in a row today, and I never listened to anything more than once, twice, maybe.
Jack Jones mostly wrote that, Jack. I've got a couple of lines, but, you know, write a word, nick a third. He's a great songwriter, that lad, and I'm really honoured that he's let me have that tune. Yeah, a bit like For Lovers in a way.
Yeah, just, it definitely is. Like, and so like with this, this is your pride and joy now for a little while.
Yeah, you have to follow your heart, don't you? Yeah. These are all my tunes that I have now, that I believe in, and that I don't have any trouble getting up and singing again and again.
Is there any Libertines tracks that you can't sing? Or Baby Shambles tracks?
You don't really know until you're halfway through and the first line, like, and then you think, oh no, I can't do this.
Yeah.
I cannot do this. Either plough on.
Gotta be done. Speaking of ploughing on, I'm going to get ploughed on through by your manager if I don't wrap this up right now. But thank you very much for giving me that demo. Like, I mean, I've probably listened to the second album or the first album, I'm not sure which one I've listened to more, but more, I've definitely listened to them more than any most other records. Like, I grew up with that record, so thank you very much from a teenage me.
Thanks, man.
The wait is finally over and sport is back on Now TV.
It's lights out and away we go!
Where you can watch Sky Sports, Premier Sports and BT Sport together and all without a contract.
What a fantastic part!
So whether there's a day, week or whole month of action you just can't miss, you can now stream the lot.
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is your sport on your terms. Search Now TV Sports to find out more. 18 plus content streamed via internet. Full terms apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.